Good afternoon, everybody. Glad to see so many of you here today. Thanks for coming. My name is Michael Gray, and I'm on staff here at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. I hope you're enjoying your food and the water and the music, the great Ray Charles music. Yeah. We normally don't permit eating in this Ford Theater, but we made an allowance for this very special occasion today. We know that many of you are on a tight schedule and on your lunch hour, and we wanted to accommodate everyone under those special circumstances. So if I could ask everyone, please silence your cell phones, including mine. And also, I need to let you know that we do have the fire exits, two in the back and one here to my left. Also, everyone's been given this flyer that has an evaluation attached to it. If you could fill out that evaluation, and our ushers will be there to collect them at the end of the program. And the flyer also includes a coupon, a two-for-one to get in to the museum. If you haven't seen our Ray Charles exhibit yet on the second floor, it'll be up through December 31st of this year. So we really encourage you to come see it. I think you'll enjoy it. This is a real exciting day for us because we're launching an exciting new series called Sobro Sessions. And Sobro, by the way, means south of Broadway. And this series is a partnership between the Country Music Hall of Fame and Vanderbilt University. Many of you are aware that Vanderbilt's Public Affairs Office for several years has been sponsoring these lunchtime seminars with the Nashville Public Library and TPAC. And these events have really added to the entertainment and intellectual excitement happening downtown. While providing free food. So the new Sobro Session series is modeled on those, and we hope it will be a great example of how the university and museum partnership can work to the benefit of this community. The Hall of Fame, you know, we envision ourselves as a gathering place for the community where we can engage in meaningful interchange about music and culture with our neighbors. So we thank Vanderbilt for being our dance partner on this and making this happen. And with that said, I want to bring to the podium Gail Carr-Williams, who's the Associate Director of Community, Neighborhood, and Government Relations in the Public Affairs Department at Vanderbilt. And she's also a member of our Ray Charles Advisory Board, which is a small group who's advised the museum staff on potential school and public programs and have helped us promote awareness in the community about the exhibit and the program. So please welcome Gail.
Thank you, Michael. Well, it's exciting to be here today. Good afternoon, everyone. Some faces I see out here are familiar, some new faces. It's always great to see everybody come out and visit us on these great occasions when we're outside of Vanderbilt and inside the community. It's always a great opportunity for Vanderbilt. As I go, I just want to say thank you to a few people for today's lunch and being able to bring about this partnership. Michael's awesome. Michael knows everything you want to know about music. And it was sort of like I met with him about something one day. I'm like, oh God, we got to do something. He's so excited. He's so much fun. And I think you all get an opportunity to see a whole lot of that. And plus, he took a lot of what I was going to say about community partnerships, so now I don't have to talk about it. So I'm really excited about that too. And Justine Gregory, who's up at the top, who is here at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and Jay Orr, they've been just great partners for us to work with. And as always, Misty White. I mean, you all know Misty. You all always email her, those of you who frequently come to our program. She gets our lunches together. She takes care of all of us all the time. And she's just done had tremendous work to make this partnership work as well. So I just want to say thank you, Misty, very much for this. And how lucky is Vanderbilt to have Peter visit us and be an active citizen and a faculty member here at Vanderbilt right now? It's just really exciting. So on behalf of Vanderbilt, I also want to thank Peter for being here and extending himself beyond Vanderbilt and being a part of the Nashville community in such a meaningful way. It's just a great thing. With that, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting our Vanderbilt programs outside in the community, the ones with TPAC, the ones with the library, and now here in SoBro. So it's a great opportunity for us to be here at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. Thank you very much for being here, and I'm going to give it back to Michael. Thank you.
Okay, the way this will work is Peter will speak for about 20 minutes, and then he'll take questions from the audience, and then about 1 p.m. We'll wrap it up right on time, because I know a lot of you need to get back to work and everything. And but then Peter is going to go over to the museum store just across the conservatory to the store, and he'll be happy to sign books there. We've got his various books there for sale. But before I bring him out, I have a video where we have a video that we want to show of Ray Charles performing the song "I Got a Woman." This is from Shindig, 1965, and you do get to see the Shindig dancers. And, and I'll tell you what, I do need to apologize that this clip does have time code on it. Believe it or not, there are only two known vintage clips, I mean from like the 50s and 60s, of Ray doing this song on television. One of them is from a movie, and that wouldn't have worked because, well, it just wouldn't have worked in this context. And then the other we got from a friend of ours at Time Life, and the only way we could get it was with time code on it, so I apologize for that, but it's a great performance. I think the performance will outshine any distraction. So here we go, rolling Ray.
It was first a smash 10 years ago, and it's been consistently reappearing in the charts ever since. Today, the recording that is currently climbing to the top is by the man who composed and recorded the original hit version of "I Got a Woman," Mr. Ray Charles.
Sometimes you know that I get a little worried now. Oh, but I don't care because it's all right. I say it's all right. That's because I've got a woman.
Man, wasn't that great? Peter informed me that when Howlin' Wolf was on Shindig, they didn't have the dancers. Hey, real quick about this photo. This was taken just a few miles away in north of Nashville at a roller rink called Maceo's in 1959. That's about the time what I'd say was hitting, of course, becoming the life of a million parties. And the fellow looking back there in the middle of the photo is Hank Crawford, who was at Tennessee State University. This is the Raylettes had just sort of new to the road show at this time. And the person there next to Ray playing saxophone is David Fathead Newman, Ray's longtime friend and saxophone player, who, by the way, we're going to have here near the end of the year for the big closing exhibit. So we look forward to that, having Mr. Newman here. With your flyer, you'll see that there's a biography printed on the flyer, Peter's bio. It's very abbreviated. A number of trees would have been killed if we would have listed all his credentials, all the books and liner notes he's written, the documentaries he's produced, his list of prestigious awards, his Grammy Awards, and everything else. But really, what I want you to know is that he truly embodies this partnership between the Country Music Hall of Fame and Vanderbilt as much as any speaker could. Peter lives in Massachusetts with his wife, Alexandra, who's here. Alexandra? And and as Gail said a long time ago, we knew we wanted to do some sort of Ray Charles program with Vanderbilt, and we were just trying to figure out exactly what it should be. And then when we realized that Peter was going to come to Vanderbilt and live here for a semester and teach there, it became very obvious what that program should be. And naturally, we invited Peter to give a presentation on Ray Charles, and then it was his idea to specifically focus on I Got a Woman. And of course, being a music museum, we treat music history pretty serious around here. And our staff of historians and curators, journalists, librarians, archivists, and educators all hold Peter and his work in the highest regard. He is widely acknowledged as being the top person in his field. He has really set the bar for researching and writing about music. He's a scholar, and though he's so thorough and sharp, his writing comes across very accessible and unpretentious. And we trust his ears. I can't tell you how much, like a lot of you, I'm sure, I can't tell you how much great music I've been exposed to through Peter's work. I mean, going back to his first book, Feel Like Going Home, in 1971, he was writing about the likes of Johnny Shines and Skip James when hardly anybody else was doing so. And he's universally respected, not only by academics and museum professionals and fellow music journalists, I see some of you out there, and music fans in everywhere, but also he's absolutely trusted by the musicians themselves. And I see some of you musicians out there too. and they personally seek him out and want him to be involved in their biographies, their liner notes, their film documentaries. And he's just been a really good friend to us at the Hall of Fame, and totally understands what we've been trying to do here with our Night Train in Nashville and Ray Charles exhibits, looking at how these artists crossed racial and cultural barriers, and by doing so exemplified the ways in which country and R&B musicians have influenced each other and have shared musical styles and songs and themes and instruments. In fact, last year, when Peter was publishing his wonderful biography on Sam Cooke, you know, he went on a book tour, and he had to convince his big publishing company in New York, kind of make it clear to them that it made perfect sense for him to promote a Sam Cooke book at the Country Music Hall of Fame. Of course, we totally got it, but we really appreciate you coming here on that tour. He did a Q&A with my boss Jay Orr in this room, and then we had a big tribute to Sam Cooke over at BB King's with folks that were in the Night Train exhibit, like Bobby Hebb and Charles Walker and Frank Howard and people like Dan Penn were on that show as well. And Peter's done other things for us. I know he's spoken about Elvis in this room, and he's contributed to our magazine, the Journal of Country Music. He's attended our programs here, our Nashville Cats and Poets and Prophets shows, and we'll miss him when he's gone. His residency at Vanderbilt ends this week, but we trust he'll be back. I want to note that when we were creating the Ray Charles exhibit, we used Peter's writings on Ray as a part of our research. I know he did a lengthy Washington Post on Ray when Ray signed to the Music Row division of Columbia Records and really was starting to make country music for the country audience. And then he has quite a bit about Ray and his wonderful book, Sweet Soul Music. So we were relying on that when we were putting the exhibit together. We're also just called him for other advice. For instance, some of you may have been to the program we had here with former Ray Lett, Mabel John. Well, it was certainly Peter who called our attention to how wonderful Mabel is and that we should have her here and helped us get in touch with her. And as the original, we have the original 78 for I Got a Woman on display in the exhibit. And the label copy reads, it has been said that I've Got a Woman, the groundbreaking fusion of gospel and blues that gave Charles his first major hit in 1955, exerted as a profound an influence on the course of American popular music as any single record before or since. Well, where it says, it has been said, really it should say, Peter Grolnick said. And Peter's been kind enough, he's donating his time to be with us here today, so we really appreciate that. And it's, we have that one sentence about I've Got a Woman in the exhibit, but having a program like this really allows us to expound on that and dig deeper with the experts. And that's why programs like this are really important to us here at the museum. So please help me. Please join me in welcoming Peter Guralnick.
Thanks to Michael, thanks to Gail, thanks to all my friends here at the country at the Country Music Hall of Fame, to Jay and to Kyle and everybody else. Thanks to all of you for coming. But I thought that since this is the Country Music Hall of Fame, and since country music, as we all know, is based so much on telling stories, I thought I'd tell you a story. Now, in the spring of 1954, Ray Charles put together his own band. He did this. He almost had to, he told me, because I was going crazy, man. I was losing my fucking head. Because, you know, you go into a town, and the guy says he got the musicians, and the musicians ain't shit. And if you're a very fussy person like me, and I mean I'm fussy even about good musicians, well, I just couldn't take it. Once he got his band, he appointed the trumpet player, Renal Richard, musical director, for an extra $5 a week. He paid him another $5 to write out the charts, according to Ray's extremely meticulous dictation, as they drove along in Ray's brand new 1954 DeSoto. Ray dictated fast, Richard told biographer Michael Lydon, and he didn't work out the chart and the chords as he played them on the piano. He'd give me the parts transposed, do one instrument onto the next, and I'm writing and writing. They listened to the radio in the car, too. Ray loved blues singers like Big Joe Turner, and Al Richard said, but most of all, he loved gospel singers. He used to talk all the time about Archie Brownlee, the lead singer with the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi, how much he liked him. Then he started to sound like him, turning his notes, playing with him to work the audience into a frenzy. They had just played South Bend in early October and were on their way to Nashville, interestingly enough, with the radio tuned to whatever gospel music they could pick up as the stations faded in and out in the middle of the night. Could have been LAC. All of a sudden, a new number came on the air. It was a completely different take on the old spiritual "There's a Man Going Around Taking Names," with a kind of tremolo guitar accompaniment like the Pop Staples approach that would later become familiar to pop audiences, that was getting more and more fashionable with the previously unaccompanied gospel quartets. The tenor singer took the lead on a pair of verses that began at the high end of his range, with the first line repeated in the slightly higher register and the third rising yet again, to a point where the singer's voice broke intentionally, the same way that Ray broke his voice in a kind of yodel on songs like "Feeling Sad" or "Don't You Know." Almost without thinking about it, Ray and Renal Richard started singing along, only with secular words. After the second verse, the song broke into a kind of syncopated patter between the tenor and the bass singer, the kind of thing the Golden Gate Quartet would frequently milk for novelty effect, but which in the contemporary gospel mode could be extended, particularly in live performance, to create a kind of dramatic tension that was resolved only by returning to the verse. Ray and his band director really broke themselves up on this part as they substituted secular and profane variations on the spiritual message until the song came to an end and the gospel jock moved on to another number or a commercial break. Ordinarily, that would have been the end of it, but there was something about the song that got to Ray in a way he couldn't put his finger on. And rather than explore it himself, he asked Renal if he thought he could write out an arrangement and some lyrics structured around their improvisation. I said, "Hell yes," Renal recalled years later. The next morning, I was in his room with it. I didn't really write it all that night. I stuck in the bridge from another song I had written years before. Always a good trick. That was the origin of "I Got a Woman." Ray talks about it in his autobiography, Brother Ray, and Michael Lydon writes about it in his book, Ray Charles, Man and Music. But until recently, no one ever knew the identity of the gospel record that Ray and Renal Richard had sung along with, or if they did, they never mentioned it. And the thing is, I'm counting on all of you to take an oath of confidentiality. Don't tell anyone out there, okay? All right, now I'm going to tell you another story. And this has something to do with the nature of discovery as well as the identity of the record. While I was writing my biography of Sam Cooke, I became intrigued and considerably mystified by the lack of biographical information on Bob King, the original guitarist for Sam's gospel group, the Soul Stirrers. Very little was known about King, and what was thought to be known appeared to be untrue. I asked Leroy Croom, who took King's place with the Stirrers in 56, about him, but all Leroy could tell me was that Bob had died just before he himself came into the group. Then one day I was reading a book about the Dixie Hummingbirds by Jerry Zoltan, and I saw a picture of the Birds' guitarist Howard Carroll with his boyhood friends, JoJo Wallace, the great guitarist for the Sensational Nightingales, and Rudolph Bob King. I called up Jerry. I didn't know Jerry, but I called him up, and he put me in touch with Howard Carroll. And Howard confirmed that, yes, indeed, Rudolph was invariably known as Bob, and this was the same Bob King who had played with the Soul Stirrers. In fact, Bob had gotten his job with the Soul Stirrers through Howard Carroll, who was not only a lifelong friend, but Bob's brother-in-law. But, Howard hastened to assure me, Bob King wasn't any rank amateur when he joined the Soul Stirrers in 1955. He had played for a couple of years before that with a quartet called the Southern Tones. Okay, now this may all sound pretty murky, but you've got to understand research frequently involves venturing into murky territory and carries with it its own perils and rewards. Well, at this point, as you can obviously tell, I was practically obsessed with Bob King. I called up JoJo Wallace, the Gales guitarist. I got in touch with King's widow, Edith, and I called gospel experts Doug Saroff and Opal Lewis Nations about the Southern Tones, who had recorded for Duke, and, well, I didn't know this at the time, but I'm sure you all know they were the successors to the very popular Bells of Joy. Now, I don't know if it was Opal or Doug, and it was probably both, who said, you know, the Southern Tones recorded a song that was kind of like I Got a Woman. They didn't know whether it came before or after, and they didn't much care. Their focus, understandably, was gospel. Before I play it for you, well, all right, let me tell you a couple of other things. When I heard the song, I was just totally bowled over. I had been asking people for 25 years if they knew what song I Got a Woman came from. I had been asking gospel singers about it, and no one seemed to know. Alex Bradford was always a good guess, but no record ever turned up. Sam Cooke's friend and business partner and the manager and tenor singer with the Pilgrim Travelers, J.W. Alexander, told me he assumed it was just a traditional gospel number, but he didn't know what it was. Taylor Hackford called me up when he started filming Ray and asked if I knew the origin of the song. He said he had asked Ray himself, and Ray said, well, what did you come up with all your research? When Taylor was forced to confess he had come up with absolutely nothing, Ray said, well, I guess it just doesn't exist then. I called Taylor as soon as I heard the record, but it was too late for inclusion in the movie. Anyway, here it is, It Must Be Jesus by the Southern Tones.
Oh, there's a man going around.
Must be Jesus. Must be Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
Must be Jesus.
There's a man.
Just a little bit of I Got a Woman.
I got a woman way over town.
That was my good fade on that. I should tell you, now this is a funny thing. This just goes to show you how research goes in circles. When this was announced, there being the internet, which is, what's the internet made up of? Is it tubes? Tubes, yeah. I got an email from a guy named Joel Dufour, whom I don't know, in France, who writes for Soulbag, and he said, you know, I think I've got something that could help you out on this talk. And he independently, I'd say at virtually the same time, had discovered the same thing through talking with Ronald Richard and then finding the record. And, you know, I told him it was in a parenthesis in my Sam Cooke biography, but he hadn't read the biography yet. So, but I mean, you know, it's just nobody, there's no reason, it's not a question of taking credit for it. It's just, it was, for me, it was just so interesting. Anyway, the impact of the record. Well, let me just back up for a second. Right after Ronald put the song together, and after they had tested it out for a few weeks in live performance, during the course of which Ronald Richard left the band, Ray called up Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, the heads of his label, Atlantic Records, and announced that he was coming to Atlanta for a show at the Royal Peacock. This was the Royal Peacock on Sweet Auburn Avenue, just down the street from Ebenezer Baptist. Now, he was ready, he said, to record. It was October of 1954, Ray had never called a session on his own before. Ahmet and Jerry had never heard his band either. But from the first notes, they knew. It was as if Ahmet said he was simply announcing, "This is who I am. This is who I'm going to be from now on." It was such a departure, Wexler said. The band was his voice. The record came out in December of 1954, and it hit like an atom bomb. Not just in terms of gospel and R&B, but in terms of rock and roll, which of course had yet to be named, and the whole course of popular music still to come. Just to give a few examples, Elvis Presley added it to his repertoire virtually from the day it came out and recorded it at Sun in early 1955, although he didn't get a version he was satisfied with until after signing with RCA a year later. Little Walter, the great blues harmonica player, had recorded a song called My Babe by Willie Dixon in mid-1954. It was what Willie called a Howlin' Wolf-type blues, but once Willie heard I Got a Woman, he rewrote the song and took Little Walter back into the studio to cut it to the tune of Sister Rosetta Tharpe's classic spiritual, This Train. It went to number one on the R&B charts and stayed there for 5 weeks. Art Roop, the head of Specialty Records, one of the two leading gospel labels in the country and the home of the Soul Stirrers, like virtually every other independent record label owner in the country, saw the future open up right in front of his eyes. "Try to write words in the blues field," he wrote in a letter to one of his star spiritual singers and composers, Sister Winona Carr. "Write words in the blues field to songs in the gospel field that have been hits in the past. For example, you know what Ray Charles did with I Got a Woman. Also, Little Walter took This Train and made it into My Babe, and it was a big hit. That," he wrote, "seems to be what the people are buying today." This is just within months. "And even if you yourself cannot sing these numbers in your style, we certainly need them desperately for our other artists." He followed up almost immediately by getting back to a Macon performer named Little Richard Pennyman, who had been pestering him incessantly about a demo he had sent to the Specialty office. Up until that moment, Roop just hadn't been able to see the potential of an overtly secular performer who sounded like a cross between gospel singers Marion Williams and Professor Alex Bradford. Now he did see that potential. He signed Little Richard immediately, and before long put out Tutti Frutti, one of the cornerstones of rock and roll, in an ear-shattering fusion of driving gospel and R&B. Sam Cooke, another specialty artist, was the last link in the chain. He was the 24-year-old lead singer with the Soul Stirrers, one of the top gospel quartets in the country, and he himself was known as the matinee idol of the music, the man who, as Bobby Womack said, brought sex into the church. You couldn't go any higher in the spiritual field than Sam Cooke. But from the day I Got a Woman was released, he was under unrelenting pressure, both internal and external, to cross over. It started in earnest in the summer of 1955 when both Bill Cooke, the highly influential R&B DJ who managed Roy Hamilton, and Specialty's A&R head, Bumps Blackwell, both started telling them that he could go places in pop he could never go in gospel, that he could take the music to a level of popular acceptance far beyond what Ray Charles had achieved. Bill Cooke, the DJ, was based in Newark, and he brought Sam not just to the attention, but to the offices of Atlantic Records over and over again, though nothing ever came of it due to Sam's own ambivalence. By the end of 1956, though, he had made up his mind and went into the studio for his first pop session, but under the name of Dale Cooke, so as to disguise the fact that Sam Cooke, the gospel singer, was making a pop record. The number with which he crossed over as Dale Cooke, Lovable, was a direct translation of his current gospel hit, Wonderful. It didn't fool anybody. And while it was only moderately successful, his first pop single under his own name, You Send Me, went to number one on the pop charts less than a year later. After that, the floodgates just opened. One gospel singer after another followed Sam Cooke's path into pop. And Sam Cooke and Ray Charles provided the direct model, the blueprint, for the gospel-based soul music from Otis Redding, James Brown, and Wilson Pickett to the whole Motown movement that dominated the 60s. Just to back up for a minute, certainly there had been gospel-inspired R&B songs before, what were called inspirational numbers, like Faye Adams' Shake a Hand or Roy Hamilton's version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's You'll Never Walk Alone. But before I Got a Woman, there had never been so direct and blatant a transcription of an actual gospel song. It was seen as sacrilege by some. Preachers denounced the new music from the pulpit. Mahalia Jackson decried its moral ambiguity. Even a prominent blues singer like Big Bill Brunzi could protest he's mixing the blues with the spirituals. He should be singing in a church. But all that quickly passed, because this was the foundation for a mass movement that swept the globe. This became the underpinning for the music that we've come to know as rock and roll. Religious fervor, or perhaps I should say a fervor akin to a spiritual awakening, was the acknowledged inspiration for everyone from Clyde McFadder and Elvis Presley to James Brown, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Johnny Cash. But before I Got a Woman, it existed as a kind of secret code. As rockabilly singer Sleepy LaBeef, a musical disciple of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, said of his own reaction to Elvis's first record, "I knew exactly where he was coming from. I thought, here's somebody singing just like we have in church for years, only he was putting that gospel feel to blues lyrics. That was what was so different about him." Everyone who really knew the music knew where it was coming from, but after I Got a Woman, it could come right out and proclaim itself, both the gospel and the African-American influence. Just as a kind of postscript, Jerry Wexler told me one time how he played Elvis's version of the song for Ray right after Elvis's record came out. He thought for sure Ray would be knocked out, but Ray, he said, was unimpressed. Ray, in fact, wasn't much interested in rock and roll at all. Like Elvis and Charlie Parker, like Hank Williams and Howlin' Wolf, what he was dedicated to was expressing himself according to his own lights. "I never was interested in my influence," he told me. "I was interested in my music." As far as all the controversy went, Ray said with typical candor, "I really didn't give a shit. I always thought blues and spirituals were close, both musically and emotionally. The minute I started being me, that was all I knew. I couldn't be nothing else." And that was the way he continued to be, whether he was singing country and western or Georgia on My Mind, whether he was playing jazz or gut bucket blues. He became a universally embraced, almost mythic figure in a way that no other popular African-American entertainer, with the possible exception of Louis Armstrong, has ever approached. He was the bishop, the right reverend, the high priest of soul, the genius. In the words of NAACP chairman and civil rights pioneer Julian Bond, he seduced the world with his voice. Now I want to take your questions, but again, remember that oath of secrecy that you all took before you, that you all signed before you came in here, so just don't tell anybody. So any questions at all on any subject at all, almost any subject at all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question about originality and does it really exist? And I would say no, it doesn't. I mean, I think we all build on, you know, the shoulders of those who went before, or on the achievements of those who went before. And I think it's a great fallacy of our age, in a sense, that we the concept of intellectual property has gained so much primacy. And really, all that's about is property. But as far as what, you know, the inspiration comes from, whether it's music or literature or anything in the arts, and probably anything in the realm of ideas, it's in the air. And it's there for anybody to, you know, to pick up on. And it's one of the reasons why the whole concept, I think, of theft, I mean, this is, I wouldn't accuse Ray Charles of theft any more than I would accuse, I feel like you have to see that this stuff is out there, and it's the way in which it's used that gives it its originality. But I mean, blues, for example, is a cultural legacy. It's the expression of a community. There are people who express themselves more originally than others, but basically, Howlin' Wolf, Robert Johnson, B.B. King, I mean, they're singing music with which which they grew up, but they're giving it their own twist, and that's what's important, is the twist.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you didn't think of... Right. Yeah. No, I'm in, this is really about what does an artist put out there when they express themselves, whether, and, you know, I'm in total agreement with the questioner that they are expressing something that's deep within themselves, and so whether the words are original or they're not, whether, I mean, nobody sang the music like Ray Charles, and he became himself. Ray Charles started his career, as I'm sure most of you know, and as he himself said, imitating popular blues singers like Charles Brown and like Nat King Cole. I mean, he loved Nat King Cole, and I think if he could, he would have given anything to have, his great hero was Art Tatum. But the point is that he put together all of these influences, blues, gospel, country. I mean, every type of influence, and to create Ray Charles music. And I think that that's the fundamental thing. And this is the way to look at, you know, the music or the art of any great original is it's not that it's original in every element, but it's original through being the expression of the person who is, the individual expression of the person who is creating it. Yeah.
Since we're here, can you talk? What are your thoughts on how Ray brought some of this stuff let loose here into country when he came into terms of the country
direction? How Ray brought, you know, what we've been listening to today and into country? I think that what Ray said is true, that he discovered his voice. It was right around when he got his own band, he discovered his own voice. I mean, as much as Bob Wills's band was an expression of his musical vision, or Merle Haggard's band, I went to a sound check once of Merle's when he had most of or a great many of the old Texas Playboys plus his own band, and the sound check went on for about 3 hours, and all I could think about was Duke Ellington. About how this was the expression of his voice. I mean, it was so much better than any show I've ever seen, and he was so much into the music, but I mean, because this was how he expressed himself. And so for Ray, I don't think it was not a question of genre. It was absolutely not a question of genre. When he turned to singing country music in the early 60s, he was certainly familiar with country music. He had sung with the, the Florida Playboys, I think, in St. Petersburg. Or maybe not St. Pete, Jacksonville. But in any case, this is when he was just right after his mother died, when he was maybe 16 years old, 17 years old. But the point is that what he brought to the music, what he brought to country music, was exactly the same thing as what he brought to everything else. You can listen to Ray, you know, he was far removed from his career as a blues singer late in life, but you can listen to him sing the blues later, and he brings the same thing to it. And it's just that feeling from deep down within, and the sum of all of his experience and the kind of musical insight with which he was born and which came to fruition once he discovered how to express himself, not to express himself like somebody else, not to try to sound like Charles Brown, which he was extremely good at, but to sound like Ray.
When you found the song that inspired I've Got a Woman, I was curious, was that almost accidental? You were really trying to find out more about, was it Bob King?
Yeah.
And so you weren't really looking for that. You just found it.
Yeah. No, it was the accidental nature of discovery, whether scientific or you know, musical. I mean, but you know, it's a funny thing in life. I mean, I remember I met Mickey Gilley right after Room Full of Roses broke, and I went down to Pasadena, you know, where Gilley's was, and met Sherwood Cryer and him. And the point is, he had recorded Room Full of Roses for the jukebox at Gilley's, he had pretty much given up on the idea of popular success at this point. And he, you know, they put it on the jukebox, and he said the bass, I think it was the bass, was over-recorded, and he thought it sounded horrible. Well, it was at the point that he just gave up that he finally achieved the success that he'd been struggling for all that time. So sometimes things just creep up on you. But in terms of, you know, yeah, no, I thought it was pretty, I mean, it was pretty ironic that I had set out to look for, I mean, I was just fascinated all those years. And I would ask everybody I talked to about I Got a Woman and never came up with a single thing. And then I'm looking for Bob King, who was, I mean, you can hear him on It Must Be Jesus. He sings and he plays guitar. It's a terrific cut, and he was, you know, a very talented guy, but almost completely unknown. And that was entirely the way in which it was no great credit to me other than that I kept on asking the wrong question. Yeah. Well, I mean, do you mean the performance on Shindig or the original?
I'm talking about I Got a Woman, what, 5 years later?
What did I say is another example of the accidental in terms of discovery, because I think What Did I Say was created when he ran out of material at a, you know, one of those dances that runs from 9 p.m. to question mark, and was just fooling around with the Raelettes and came up with this. The riff was maybe, I'm not remembering it completely, but I mean the riff was something maybe that he had worked with, but the song itself was put together on the spot. But I think you can see that by the time of What Did I Say, which was 5 years after he had recorded I Got a Woman, he's made the total transition into a gospel-based sound, and he's added a choir, I mean, in the Raelettes. I mean, the Raelettes, I forget exactly when they came along in the studio. They had been the Cookies, and they had recorded as the backing group at Atlantic for a lot of groups, and he took over the Cookies, and then they evolved into the Raelettes, and there were a number of Raelettes groups. But the point is that he conceived of it more and more in the years following I Got a Woman as something where he just followed a straight gospel model, and it became much more up-tempo and maybe much more oriented towards a broader market than, I mean, to me, the greatest thing about Ray Charles is not so much when he's performing at a fast tempo as when he brings the tempo down to almost nothing, where it's just, I mean, very, very few musicians can sustain a song when they bring the beat down just to where it's almost, it's barely there. And what's that song, It Brings a Tear to My... Drown in My Own Tears. I mean, the performance of that at Herndon Stadium, which is right around the time he did What Did I Say, at Herndon Stadium in 1959 on that live album, is just one of the most amazing performances of all time, and for me, one of the most soulful. And it's not that, I mean, Ray couldn't do anything that wasn't soulful, but the way in which the tempo, it's almost like it's just deadened. It just sits there, and Ray can carry it. And that I think, is just one of the most extraordinary things of all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, this is about Ray in 1961 in Lexington, Kentucky, seeing him and just the way in which he raised the bar. And I saw him just about that time in Boston at a show in Jordan Hall, which is a concert hall in Boston. And No, I mean it was just an amazing. I was in high school, and it was just an amazing performance. And one of the two ways in which Ray raised the bar, I think, were first of all in his musicality. I mean, he was someone who heard everything, and I think this would be true of someone like Sam Cooke. It would be true of a very small number. You have a lot of people who may have hits, but very few who can create a whole sound and who have the kind of ears that are just going to hear everything. The second trumpet, missed that note, or the Ray was extremely demanding in what he was looking for, and what he was looking for was something to extend his sound, not necessarily to recapitulate some written notes. But the other thing about Ray was that as a performer, he did, as Renaud Richard said, at some point he took in the spirit of Archie Brownlee, who, if any of you have ever listened to the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi, I mean, you'll know this was the foundation for all the screamers from Wilson Pickett to James Brown to everybody, but Ray just had such an extraordinary. You could get it in that Shindig performance to some extent. If you'd seen him live, you would get it even more. But he just it was not a restrained performance. It was a performance in which everything was done according to a standard, but in which the uninhibited emotion of the moment, was what held sway most of all. And I think the ability to convey that, to communicate that, and still keep things under control is the mark of a really extraordinary performer. So I think we just have time for, one or two more? Who wants to be last? The first should be last.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it probably is still common practice if people still played live music, or if they if they didn't do the tracks. But I mean, I remember this is whether Ray going out and without his own band and just playing with a pickup band was common practice. But I mean, for example, if a performer came into the Apollo or the Howard or the Uptown, they performed with the house band and they brought their own charts. And if they didn't have their own charts, they paid a lot of money for their own charts because that was the accompaniment they were going to get. It was very rare that you had somebody like James Brown who created his own self-sustaining unit. When I first saw Otis Redding, it was on the hot summer shower of stars of 1964, and it was Otis's band, or at least it was billed as Otis's band, that backed the performers up, but the other singers on the bill, Solomon Burke, who was the headliner, Rufus Thomas, Sugar Pie DeSanto, they were all being backed up by a band that they hoped was going to play well for them. But there was never any guarantee. The reason, for instance, that Sam Cooke got his band got his own band was because he just got tired of being messed up. I mean, he went out there are various stories about how he was messed up by the headliner's band just for fear that he would take the show. And at that point, he put together his own band. So it's an expensive item, but it's not a luxury to have your own band if you're serious about presenting your own music. Well, I guess we've run out of time, but listen, I thank you very much and really enjoyed it.